Welcome back to Value Flow Over Resource Utilization. Here's where we slay one of the very first of the assumptions that people have and that people make about what is good in software, resource utilization being one of those. Let's do some definitions.
Right.
A couple axioms, why you should care. Let's go through some a demo on this and then talk about a better way. Utilization rate is complicated. What does it mean for someone to be utilized?
So the definition that we're going to work with today is your utilization rate is the percentage of time someone can bring you something new to work on, net new item, and you're not currently doing something. So if I bring, do this to Steve, Steve doesn't have to stop doing something in order to start working on that. He doesn't have to put something aside. So your utilization rate is the percentage of time I can come to Steve and he's not working on anything.
That's a great definition of utilization. It's a hard one for people to sometimes grasp, but it's a simple one, and it's measurable. Andrew comes to me, he hands me this eraser and says, please do something with this eraser. If I have to say, I'll get to that in a bit, I'm utilized.
Yep. So if I were to say Steve's utilization rate is 90%, that means that 90% of the time when I come to him with something new, he's already working on something.
That's perfect. So variability, on the other hand, is the measure of distribution over a set of values. Every process, at least in the humans world, has some variability. Even manufacturing, but the variability is very small, 1% or 2%. When we get to software development, variability is not like that at all. If I give you an estimate of 2 weeks, and it takes exactly 2 weeks, that's pretty unlikely. It's either going to take me 3 days, it's going to take me 4 weeks. There could be a pretty big distribution in there. That's our variation and our variability.
My personal favorite for this one is if you told me it was going to take you 2 weeks and then it actually took you 2 weeks, you're probably lying to me. Because the odds of that happening are astronomically small, right? Like, I'll get it to you Friday by 5. No. Because you don't know how long it's going to take, right? If you actually finish it Friday at 5, if you deliver it to me Friday at 5, that means you finished it sometime during the day Friday and then sat on it for a few hours and then delivered it to me at 5, right? So understanding that's what we're talking about with variability. We're also talking about the variability in the size of items in general. It's impossible to break down every unit of work in a software development lifecycle to the exact same size, right? We can't say all of our tasks will be 4 hours long and no longer than 4 hours, right? So we have to manage tasks and value through our system that is variable in length just by nature. There's no way to break it down into similar sized pieces, right? If you're making a screw, every screw made is going to take about 6 seconds with so much variation on either side, but we're not making it using the same machine to make a screw. We're using the same machine to make a screw, a bolt, a nut, a nail, a hammer, sometimes a skill saw, right? So that's also part of what we mean when we say variability.
So variation in both time to completion, and I'm also hearing you say variation in the size of the things
size
we're building.
Of items.
That's all good. So we've got those two definitions, and that leads us to value flow over utilization. Your customers probably don't buy your product because of how long or how busy you were when you created it. They're buying you for a benefit to them. They're paying you because you're giving them some feature, not for the amount of time it took. Now, people are going to argue, but we're a consultancy and they pay us for the time that we spend. If you take 100 years to deliver something, they're probably not going to keep right. paying you for that amount of time.
Right.
They pay you not for how busy you are, but for the value you create.
Yep. And a lot of ways, if you are a contracting company who builds software and gets paid hourly, there's an expectation of value delivered in that hour. And in a lot of ways, you've managed to convince your customer that you can predict that expectation of value to a level of accuracy, yeah. right? And so hopefully part of that negotiation has a variability factored into that.
Yeah, exactly, and that can be some of the pricing discussions
right.
or whatnot. So instead of managing things like how busy you are, manage things like how much value you created. Now, that does not sound controversial at all. I mean, that's just brain dead obvious when you say it like this.
Right.
And it's very clear to people. Yet, I challenge you to go back to your organization, look at the way you're currently delivering software, and see if instead of measuring the value on the output, they are instead measuring things like how busy people are, or how much of a backlog they have, or some other measure other than the value going through the
system.
How
often did you get to work in your own personal specialization, right?
Yes.
If you're a developer, how much time did you have to go spend testing compared to how much time developing SQL code because you're a SQL developer? That's one of those things. Also, utilization. Incentivization. Not only how are they measuring you, how does your organization measure your employees, but how do you incentivize your employees? How do you give promotions? How do you give raises? Is it because someone worked a 60-hour week, or is it because someone delivered X amount of value in half that time, right? We often incentivize high levels of utilization, which can have exactly the opposite effect on our employees.
Yep, and we'll talk about that opposite effect in this module. So why do you care? First of all, you care because your customers care. They want to see value delivered. That's frankly their bottom line. And if their customers are internal, external, for-profit, non-profit, doesn't matter, they care that you're giving them value. That's what they're paying for. Your organization will create more value probably while using fewer resources or the same amount of people, time, et cetera, but more value pouring through that.
Right.
And I think the most important is culture. And
right.
I'll pass that one over to you because I think that's a good one.
So this is a huge culture shift for an organization. Again, it can become a bootstrapping problem with we don't trust our employees enough and those sorts of things. But the idea is that if you can shift the culture of your organization to concentrating on delivering value, it forces your entire organization to adopt a services mindset and a customer-oriented mindset. Everything that you do relates to delivering value to the customer. All your conversations are around it. When you think of all the wonderful organizations that you've heard of that you've always wanted to work at, right? That's what we're talking about here, right? It's just such a cultural shift to commit to delivering value to your customer and not worrying about how long it took.
in the sense
of how busy you were while creating that value.
I think a great call on this culture thing was yesterday, in fact. I was talking with Greg Bohr in a podcast. Greg Bohr works at Microsoft, and he was talking about the transition that they had as they moved from kind of a long delivery cycle to shorter delivery cycles, and where they looked at how much value and features are they delivering to their customers on a fast basis. And he had an insight that really jumped out at me, and I think it was appropriate. I'll relay it here. He said, the number of, parties you threw and morale events, all of those things paled in comparison to delivering software faster. What really got people excited,
right,
what really drove their interest was faster delivery cycles. That's what drove up the engagement of their employees. That's what drove up the engagement of their customers. That's what made it a better place to work, a better culture. It wasn't because they threw parties every Thursday night.
You can, and an organization that focuses on the value delivery to that extent, as an individual developer, you can see your contributions take effect from the customer's perspective. You can see that me working on this delivered this piece of value to the customer. And when you can make that correlation as a developer, I get excited about products when I'm working on a product like that. I don't get excited about a product when I have no idea what piece of value I'm contributing to. When I'm just going to work and writing lines of code to fulfill some data contract. That doesn't get me up in the morning, right? And going to a pizza party after work, that also doesn't get me up in the morning, right? It's delivering value to customers. That's why I got in this business. That's why I love to do this. being able to focus on that exclusively and make that the most important thing is just crucial to my personal morale.
Yeah. And the team morale is just that kind of that aggregation of those. So let's take a look at some generalizations. Andrew already mentioned these. I just want to bring them back up again. Modern software takes more than one person to create, and then the value has to flow through that multiple hands. This isn't critical. It's the arguments we'll have can work with one person, but really they work when we have variability that's chained together with multiple hands dealing with it, multiple hands touching it. So that's where it's most impactful, is with teams of people that have to deliver together. Every person's contributions are going to take a variable amount. I think Andrew covered that in the intro really well. In other words, to sum up, software development is a flow-based system with inherent variability.
Right.
So, given that, let's go to our first demo. And this demo is utilization versus cycle time versus throughput. This one's going to be another whiteboard demo. It'll take us a little while to get through it, but I think it's an important one that we cover. So, let's go talk about utilization. So, as we slide over, I'm going to pick on Andrew.
Great.
And I'm going to pick on Andrew, and I'm going to draw Andrew up in the upper left-hand side.
Do I get to be the evil project manager?
There you are. No, you're not going to be the evil project manager this time.
Dang it.
Now, I'm going to give Andrew something to work on.
Okay.
And he's going to take it. He's not utilized. Brilliant. My thinking now is, man, I got to start stacking him up more stuff. I've got to give him a queue of work. Otherwise, every time I come to him, it looks like he's just goofing off. So I need to give him something to work on, right? So I can give him a stack of things to work on. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't have a billion items to give him. I'm going to start handing him work based on some variable amount of time. So today I'm going to give you one thing. Tomorrow I may have three things to give you.
Okay.
Some variable amount of time. So you're going to have a backlog of things that you need to work on. And that backlog is going to increase or decrease based on the amount of things, the variation of the stuff that I'm going to give him. So bear with the math now as we go into this. So he may have a pretty large backlog, or he may have a very small one. Now, if he's got a large backlog, what happens when I give him something new? How long does it take him to get this red one all the way down and presented to me? And the answer is longer than when he had only two other items in his queue, right? That's pretty obvious.
Right. The longer the line is, the longer it takes, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if he has a big stack of things, it's going to take him a long time to get down there. But the problem is that in addition to me giving Andrew things in a variable amount of time, he's going to be processing things also in a variable amount of time. So what that means is he's going to be ripping through these things. Some days he's going to do one. Some days he's going to do five, and now he's got nothing to work on. Okay? So now he's unutilized. So the next thing I give him, he can start work on immediately. So now that takes our definition of utilized. It takes our definition of this queue, and it gives us a couple things that I want to call out explicitly. And the explicit things I'll call out are the variable rates that I'm giving stuff to Andrew. I'm going to call that M. For those of you who do happen to be math majors in the background, that's a Markov process. So that's M. It's a variable process of me giving him work. And he is going to, in turn, process that at another variable amount of time. We're going to call that M. Now, I'm using math terms. Reality is, there's no math involved in this. It's just some basic ideas. So he's going to have a queue that he needs to burn through, and he's going to have either a small queue where he's every now and then burns through it real quickly and he's unutilized, or it's going to be a giant queue or a bigger queue where he's not going to burn down to the bottom of that queue very often, which will give him some unutilization. Now, there's one Andrew, okay? There's going to be just one of you, We'll simplify this. And how big should I let this stack get?
You want my honest answer or the game answer?
The game answer.
All right, let's do it. Let's say infinitely large, right? We want to make sure that I'm working all the time.
We're going to let this grow all the way to infinity. This queue can grow forever. We're not going to put an upper bound on it. Now, we're going to put an upper bound on
it eventually
in some of our discussions. But for right now, there's no upper bound. This gives us what is mathematically known as an MM1 infinity queue. It's an extremely well-known queue inside of queuing theory. So we're getting a little bit of queuing theory here, but not much. Not much, to be honest. Let's do another thing. Let's draw a graph. And on this graph, we're going to put utilization along the bottom. So this is going to be 100% utilization. That means every time I come to Andrew and hand him something, he's busy. He'll put it on his backlog and work it, but he is working on something else that has value that he needs to deliver. On the flip side, if every time I come to Andrew, he is 0% utilized, he's always able to start work, he falls on this side. So this is utilization. And on this side, we're going to put the amount of delay, the amount of time it takes for Andrew to get to something new that I give him. So if this is time, or we'll call it delay here. It's kind of the average cycle time might be another way to put it. So what happens if he is 0% utilized? That means every time I come to him and give him something, he's able to pick it up and handle it immediately. Well, if he's able to do that, he gets it done lickety-split. My delay is really, really low. So I've got this extraordinarily low delay. You're just cranking through things. So here you are at your very low delay. Now, what if you're busy 10% of the time? 10% of the time I come and give you something. You got a little bit more delay, but frankly, it's probably not that much more. You know, because 10% of the time, Andrew's still not working on things very much. Now, as we get closer and closer and closer to 100%, this delay, we find, follows an extremely predictable pattern in this queue. It starts to increase, and it grows exponentially as we approach 100%. And if he's 100% utilized at all times, in theory, this can grow all the way to infinity as the queue grows to infinity. In practice, that never happens,
right?
Because we, in practice, limit WIP. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But what happens is, this is all too real. Now, this is theory, right? This is an MM1 infinity queue. We've just drawn out the theory. The sad fact is that this applies very cleanly to the way that we do software development. It ties way too close to the way people react. Let me give you just an example. Me personally, when I've got a few things to work on, I can keep them in my head, I can get through them, I don't feel overwhelmed. But some people, when they get a big stack of things that people are waiting for and asking for and really pushing for, those people, me included, get caught in this paralysis phase. I've got so much to do. I can't get any one thing done. And my cycle time goes way up, and I have a bunch of unhappy friends,
right,
family, coworkers, customers, etc. So what I need to do is keep that down lower so I can get that delay. Now, this is all too real, but let's take another take at this. If I want to deliver something quickly, if I want to go in and deliver something, let's take Andrew and make him my entire software development team. If I want Andrew, or that software development team, to build something quickly and get it to me in an efficient manner, then what I would do is I'd keep their utilization reasonable. I keep it lower. Why? I get things out faster. We talked earlier how managers very often say, you've got this big molasses-like thing that I feed in these small requirements, and they take forever to get out. Why do they take forever to get out? Frankly, it's because we're running at a really high rate of utilization.
Right.
Now, I'm going to go to Silicon Valley for a moment. You may have heard companies that give people 20% time, right? So that basically what they do is they say, hey, it's Friday, work on whatever you want. You know, it's your time. So they give people 20% time. This is seen by employees as a pretty big benefit, right? I'd love 20% time, right? That's a pretty giant benefit. But the reality is it's a very hard-nosed business decision.
Yep.
Why? Let's go to the graph. If we go to 80% utilization, and we go here to 80%, and now we take a look at what the time it takes to deliver something through our system is versus running at, say, 90% utilization or 98% utilization, you've got a very, very big delta in time. So let me ask you this, Andrew. If you were working on an acoustic guitar simulator for the web, you worked for one of these Silicon Valley firms, and come Friday morning, you hadn't finished your stuff that you'd had required.
Right. And I just needed an extra maybe 2 hours.
Extra 2 hours, exactly. What would you do? Would you go work on the acoustic guitar simulator for the web, or would you finish up your tasks for the day, for the week?
Probably finish up my tasks.
Exactly. And that's what people are betting on.
Right.
As long as they load you to about 80% utilization and aren't just like saying you get 20% time, but every week you're loaded to 100%. If they're loading you to 80% time and giving you that 20%, look what that does to the speed at which they can deliver. They've lost, quote unquote, lost 20% of the development team's productivity, and they have gained an incredible amount of time. If you're in a startup or you're in a competitive industry, you are in an industry where cycle time trumps utilization. This is very, very true in a lot of cases. You might be in an industry where it counts how fast you can deliver, not necessarily what that utilization is. So I'm going to challenge you to come back and take a look at this and say, how do we get back to lower levels of utilization so that we can deliver dramatically faster.
Can I take over your graph a little
bit? I would
bit
love
here?
It.
Let's go ahead and turn this into a U-shaped optimization, right? Since we talked about those earlier. So what we can do is we can take this graph and we can go ahead and plot on here the cost of our capacity, right? So if I want to always be at 0%, it's very, very expensive, right? I have to have tons and tons of people sitting around at all times with the ability to work on something as soon as I give it to them.
But that's a great point. So 0% utilization is very expensive.
It's really expensive. It takes a lot of capacity. But if I want, say, 80%, right? As we move down and we want lower utilization rates, our cost of capacity decreases.
Right. So in other words, if I'm over here, I might have 10 people on staff as opposed to 50.
Right, yeah. So over here I've got 10 people working on the same 500 items. Over here I've got 500 people working on the same 500 items, right? So that's what we're graphing that line. And you'll notice that we've ended up with, you know, our happy U-curve optimization. And what we're really looking for this point is the point of non-linearity, right? We're looking for the point where our somewhat linear line really hits that exponential curve. And that's usually the point of optimization.
That's a great point. So we took this MM1 infinity queue. I made this assertion, hey, 80% time is great. And Andrew came back and said, wait, let's talk about the economics, right? And pulled us back to that economics discussion. And when he did that, he laid on that additional cost curve.
Right.
And that gives us our U-shaped optimization, which says that we can be off a little bit in either way, and it's probably going to be okay. And if we step off, as Andrew noted, onto the nonlinear side, we're going to know that right away.
Yep.
That'll be painful. I love it. That's a perfect way to take over that curve, but to then see how that utilization piece shapes out. So 80% may not be optimal. The way you've driven it might be 70%
right.
utilization. How on earth do you sell this to management? How do you go to management and say, by the way, our people have too much to do. We want them sitting around 70% of the time. This is probably not a good argument to have with management.
Well, hopefully your managers are smart enough to understand a graph like this, though, right? I mean, because this is economics 101. This is not a super complicated, you know, it's a supply and demand curve, right?
Right.
It's not a super complicated concept. And if you can draw it out and explain it in a language that they understand, you're going to have a lot more success with that. But Steve will get into an alternative method for how to explain this maybe in a little bit different way.
Exactly. Your point is taken, though. You don't need to dumb things down for managers. I am shocked I shouldn't be shocked.
Right.
But when I started out, I was shocked. Talking to management, I'd always assumed that very senior management would not kind of understand this in a way that would resonate. I'm completely wrong. Managers, when presented with this, do not do what the mid-level managers think they will say, which is,
yes.
No, get to work. Get to
yes.
work, you. Type faster.
That's so true. And that's why one of my points of emphasis is always that management has a role to play in here, right? We really need to bring this back to a realm of managers understand economics. So if we can speak that language, we're all on the same team and we're delivering value. I mean, if we can translate that well, we can all work together instead of the old school, let's hide things from our managers and let's try to obscure this conversation.
Yep.
We obscured it because we were speaking two different languages. If we start speaking the same language, we don't need to obscure it anymore. We can keep everybody on the same page moving towards the same goal.
Now, having said that, no, that's perfect. But having said that, I'm going to come back to the chart and say, what do you do with this 20% time?
Right.
Working on your acoustic guitar simulator for the web might be optimal. I would rather you did that than nothing.
Right.
20% time may be a hard sell to management. How do we do it in Agile teams today? How do we do it today? We do it with a definition of done. We say in order to be complete with this value delivery, we need to have it unit tested at an appropriate level. We need to have run through its paces. It needs to be documented. It needs to get rid of some of this technical debt that we might have accrued. So we put it in our definition of done. So we're not working 100% of the time delivering value, but if push came to shove, we could give up a little bit on those definitions of done, potentially, and get this out the door. So what is being done during this time? Refactoring your code, if you're a developer.
Right.
Let's talk from a developer's perspective. What is this 20% of your time? And by the way, this curve might go out to the right further. It might be a 90% of your time, but whatever that curve is.
By the way, just as a side note, the curvature of the curve is based a lot on batch size and variability. So the variation in your process, the greater your variation in the process, the more sharply that curve is going to steep up towards the end. If you can reduce that variability, you're going to get a more linear curve. So there are some factors that you can measure that play into actually graphing this out in your own particular environments.
That's true. Or if you're using a tool like Team Foundation Server, you can go spelunk your data and
right.
just get this. A lot of this time the data will just plop out. Next thing you're going to be doing here, things like refactoring your code, possibly automating test cases, possibly doing things that can help bend that deployment curve that we right. wrote earlier, make it a little bit flatter so you can deploy more often. There might be a lot of different things you're doing here. But the fact is, you're not working when I come to you right. and you have nothing on your plate.
Right.
You're not just sitting there going, I wish I had something to do.
Backlog grooming.
You're backlog
That's
grooming.
That's one of my favorite ones.
You're doing something. You're getting ready for that next step so that when I come and I hand you the next thing to work on, you've got something you can grab a hold of immediately. But while you're waiting, you're doing other things, potentially cross-training.
Right.
You know, those sorts of things.
As long as that other thing, and this is the key, that other thing must be absolutely interruptible. That other thing cannot be something that you have to say, wait, I need another 45 minutes to finish this up. That other thing must be interruptible in order to not fall into the utilization trap. Because if you've got your 20% time where the 20% time is not interruptible, then you've effectively defeated the purpose of the whole exercise, right? So that has to be interruptible.
Now, I've erased the board because I want to go somewhere else with this when we talk about utilization. And one more thing I need to address. When we came in, we didn't grab a hold of the Q&A panel.
Oh, right.
So we are missing some of these key questions that are coming in. Rest assured, we will be back to that Q&A panel right after lunch. We're going to set aside some time to answer the questions that you've had now and going forward, right. Answering questions more as they come in. So our apologies, we'll be right on that shortly. Now, measuring utilization is tough. Because I'm not going to come to Andrew and say, here, can you work on this? And Andrew picks it up and runs with it. He probably has some things that he feels are important,
right.
Like that, those unit testing components, things that are important. And he's not going to just tell me, I'm just kind of lounging. Right. So utilization is...
No, I can't work on that, Steve. I've already been 80% this week. It's time to go down to 75. I'm not going to work right now.
Exactly. Probably not going to happen, right?
I don't know that works out all that well.
It's hard to measure utilization. So how do we start to understand utilization? And we can do that by starting to visualize what's happening on a board. And I'm going to draw a crazy board up here one more time. This comes out of the Kanban session. It's going to be a Kanban board. And I'm going to, bear with me, I'm going to separate dev and test. I know that's an evil thing to do, but I'm going to, because it is a fundamental thing from Agile. People have discovered that bringing dev and test together and sitting them in the same room together very often, or at least working temporally together, time-based, right. That they're working on the same thing together, dramatically improves throughput. So I think it's a great idea. But for the purposes here, I'm going to keep them left and right because I want to talk about them. I've got a to-do column that I'm going to be working on, and I'm going to move to a different pen. This one doesn't quite write quite as dark as I'd like. So I've got a to-do. This is my backlog. I'm going to move over to analysis. Spell that out. Dev, test, and done. These are my various columns. And I've got stuff in each of these columns. I may have a list of things that I'm working on. And I'm working on doing, or I've got a bunch of things that I need to do in a priority order. So how we see utilization show up, and we talked about flow of value, right. How we see utilization show up is flowing across this board. If I'm going to break each one of these into a doing and a done substate. If in analysis we have three items in done and nothing in doing, they are not utilized at what they are meant to be doing, their analysis phase. So what we find is this underutilization really can benefit the overall company. So watch, bear with me. We're going to do one more thing. Can I whip limit this?
Of course.
I'm going to put... I'm going to put some work in process limits in here. So in analysis, I can only be analyzing three things at any given time. That's doing and done. In development, I can also only be doing three things, and in test, let's say only two things. Those are kind of appearing out that outside. I should write them a little lower. Doesn't really matter. Doing and done, if my analysis phase, if I'm blocked here on analysis, I've done all of my analysis and my devs are still working on things. They've got three things they're working on. I'm a blocked business analyst.
Right.
What do I do at this moment in time? I'm blocked. I can't pull anything new but I'm done with all this. I look right. And we talked this more in depth in the Kanban session, and we'll talk it again in the enterprise one, but I'm going to look right and say, what do the developers do? And because I want to do more analysis, but they're blocking me because they're not doing their development fast enough. So what I do is I look to the right and I start to understand, what do the developers need? Could I have spent more time in analysis so that the developers could develop more quickly? In other words, this could be absolutely heretical to a lot of agilists out there, right, who want to put everything on just a 3x5 card. Right. And I love it. It's an absolute
that needed to make a break from our old paradigm to a new paradigm, but we need to move beyond it now.
We need to move beyond it. And if this is what I'm seeing, where my analysts are constantly blocked from doing things, let's let them spend more time on mockups,
right,
more time on a little bit deeper analysis so that the devs can deliver more quickly. Of course, we have to be sure that the analysis they're doing actually helps the devs.
Right. They would have to be able to show correlation between we've done more analysis and now development is going faster.
Right.
We wouldn't want to be just more analysis for the sake of more analysis.
Exactly. So what I've just done is I've translated utilization into something we'll talk about later, queues, and we've laid out, this is a queue of three items. So I've got this doing done column between here. We're passing things through, focusing on how quickly we can flow value through the system. That's going to be our measure. So we are going to get to utilization and tie it back to flow because we're trying to get something here through. And how we measure it is we measure it with a Kanban column, or how we light up utilization rather than measure utilization effectively. So what do we find in here? One more thing, analysis to development, development to test. If, as is more common, we've got three things in analysis, but nothing's done, and the developers are instead done with their three things, we now have a lack of utilization on the developer side. They're unutilized, because if you gave them something, they could begin working on it immediately. We can see it on the board. Now, what happens to the development team is they're starved for work. They look left into business analysis. And this is where these people might be writing very heavyweight requirements, and the developers come back and say something like, you know, there's this concept of a user story in this great book by Mike Cohn. We'd love you to read.
Yes, please, right? Go there, right?
Right? And this would cause them to start cutting back potentially on their requirements. The developers could come back and say, you're spending a lot of time on each requirement, and it's slowing us down. And they see it because of that utilization. So when people are unutilized in a real world team with a flow of value, they come back and start to contribute. They start to do things, right, that make the flow happen. Now, if I'm coming to my analysts and I'm saying, do your time cards, if you're not working on 40 hours a week worth of stuff, you're fired.
Right, and you just incentivize them to write really large spec documents that may or may not impact the flow positively.
Exactly.
Impact it negatively.
Most likely impact it negatively. They could be doing a better job providing more data to the developers and still slow down the delivery of value.
And even worse, if you're incentivizing your developers to do the same thing, they're never finishing anything either because they're also incentivized in the same way. So they're working on giant queues of work as well. And uncontrolled congestion is what I like to call that.
Absolutely. And where do you also experience uncontrolled congestion? Right?
So one of my go-to examples for this subject in general has always been traffic jams, right? Our freeway system is quite obviously a flow-based system with inherent variability, right? The cars can be different lengths, they can travel at different speeds, and we can vary the utilization rate, the number of cars on the freeway. So it's very interesting to model it quite similar to a software development where you see when we're at high level, or excuse me, when we're at low levels of utilization, everybody's moving along, you know, 9 miles an hour over the speed limit because we're American and we travel 9 miles an hour over the speed limit. but as we increase that utilization, right, we get up to maybe, should I draw this? Should we go switch to the whiteboard?
Yeah, if you like.
I like to draw this one out, so we'll walk it along. Beautiful. Thank you, Steve.
Absolutely. I thought you might want to draw it.
All right, so.
Green doesn't work.
Green doesn't work. Good point.
Red or black?
We'll go black with the green tip. Okay. We'll put utilization. It doesn't matter. So as we're traveling along at low levels of utilization, right? We're all traveling.
The time it takes you to get somewhere is pretty low, right?
It's pretty, right.
Yeah, really
our
low.
Our throughput through the system is pretty low. I'm drawing this backwards of the way I normally draw it.
Turn it around.
All right, so we're all traveling at 60 miles an hour under low rates of utilization, right? As we increase utilization, as utilization gets increased, and we'll put speed on this axis, we're going to use speed as our proxy for throughput. We're all traveling at or near the speed limit under low levels of utilization, and it doesn't drop off very fast as utilization increases, right? We can go from 0% to 20%, and we're all still traveling at the same speed. We can go from 20% to 80% to 60% or to 90%, but then you hit 95%, and we get this sudden and drastic drop-off. And we see that a lot with systems with high levels of variation. We can load them very fast to a breaking point, and that breaking point causes very non-linear reactions in throughput. It's yep. Very interesting. You see this in organizations that make the transition from the lean startup mindset to the more traditional mindset, as they say, oh, all of a sudden we need to add more QA rigor, right? And so all of a sudden that capacity just drops off dramatically. It just spikes. It's very interesting to see.
I'm gonna make this, because I want to draw it a little bit differently. I want to take, you didn't quite give me enough to work with, so I'm going to take that and give it a little bit more of a decline.
A little bit more of a curve.
A little bit more of a curve. Although, to be fair, you're right. And now I want to take it and do an upside down U-shaped optimization, right? So he wrote speed. This is the speed at which me as an individual is getting through things.
Right.
And what do I want? I want my utilization to be zero. I want to be the only person on the Autobahn, right?
Of course.
I want to get on and just go like gangbusters. But the reality is, if you're a road builder,
right,
there are other costs.
Zero utilization is very expensive.
Yes, zero utilization is very expensive. And I want to draw, this is a benefit curve. We drew it before as a cost curve.
Right.
So I'm going to draw it as a benefit curve. I get very low benefit from my road when I have low utilization. When I have high utilization, wow. I can be getting, you know, a lot of bang for my buck in terms of people parking on the road. Now granted, I'm not getting, this is a lot of cars
right.
parking on my freeway.
Which is very expensive. And they have traffic models right. that tell exactly how millions and millions of dollars are lost when that happens.
Exactly. So now we're going to sum these two, the benefits, and we're going to get a curve that looks like that. Right? When we sum these, now we get an upside down U-shaped right. curve, which gives us our optimal utilization on freeways. And utilization being the amount of pavement, basically, that's taken up by cars.
Right.
And that includes the car plus the lead.
Necessary lead between the cars.
The necessary lead between the cars. And interestingly, that optimal for American freeways, where we're driving at about 55 to 65 miles an hour, is about 60% utilization. So, again, we took the individual's look. We took a look at the road builder's look, how much concrete right. they're pouring, and we get this U-shaped value that comes out with that utilization. I kind of hijacked the talk.
It was perfect because I did the same thing to your graph.
But that gives us that U-shaped decision in reverse. One thing to take away. I personally know project managers who would look at a freeway that was 100% congested and do the project management equivalent of saying, there's free pavement.
I can fit one more car right there.
I can fit one more car. Exactly. And you don't want to do that. This is a danger. Can I soapbox for a moment?
soapbox away.
I'm going to soapbox for a little bit on lab band Gantt charting. Unfortunately, where we see utilization most strongly emphasized is in the use of Gantt charts and the use of traditional project management techniques, because you're taking people's time, and it's the time you're taking. You're not looking at the flow of value. You're looking at individuals' time estimates, aggregating them together into a Gantt chart or a PERT chart. You've seen them, the Gantt charts, right? And it's a pure look at utilization. And that is where we can get the harm from traditional project management techniques. It's not that traditional project management techniques are bad. It's that they are not effectively focusing on the right thing, which is the delivery of value. We want to focus on the delivery of value, and the proxy that Gantt charts use is, unfortunately, utilization. The proxy for delivery of value is utilization in a Gantt chart. It drives me absolutely crazy. So if you're going to make that transition as an organization from utilization into the flow of value, you're going to likely need to change a little bit your mindset. Well, you change your mindset a lot, but you're going to need to change your tooling a little bit as well. And frankly, sometimes that means getting rid of the Gantt chart as the primary method of tracking progress.
I think the Gantt chart still has a place in that it does effectively show you dependencies between tasks. And you can use it that way. You can use it to show that this thing has a dependency on this thing, which has a dependency on that thing. And that's not bad information to have. When it becomes negative is when it becomes the managerial tool by which you are measuring the system. When you use it as an information piece, it's very effective. When you use it as the measurement by which you are incentivizing and pushing value through your system, it becomes a negative. So it's very important to understand they aren't inherently horrible things, but their use can be very negative on the outcomes of your system.
I'm going to agree with Andrew, but realizing that I came from one of those places where I was an extremist, it took me a while to walk me off the Gantt charts are evil ledge and get me back to where Andrew rightfully says there can potentially be a place for those, especially if you have low variability.
Right.
I mean, the lower your variability, the closer utilization becomes to a proxy for value.
Right.
If you have zero utilization, proxy, you know, right. I mean, is zero, I'm sorry, if you have zero variability, proxy utilization becomes a really tight proxy for value delivery. We live in a very variable world. If you want to learn more about variability, put that in on some of the questions. We'll go through them over lunch. And I think it might pay for us to really talk about variability because we've touched on it, but we've kind of made assertions.
Right.
I might want to back that up a little bit and talk through it. So Gantt charts are evil. Just kidding. But be cautious. Be aware that Gantt charts use a different proxy variable for value than we encourage, which is the flow of something that has value, some feature through the system. So flow of value, far more important than utilization. Now, I have time for one more rant. And this comes directly at project management and the way we treat project plans.
Right.
Project plans, folks, if you give me a 6-month project plan or a 1-year project plan and you exactly hit every single item in that Gantt chart exactly on time and deliver exactly to plan and release at 10:52 a.m. exactly the minute it was planned, you will most likely have a failed software project. Because adherence to the plan itself tells me that what you didn't do was learn anything through that 6-month or 12-month cycle. We make assumptions that this particular feature is going to take 5 weeks to build and it's going to be valued by 50% of our users. We do some trial runs out there, we get some beta users, and we discover that same feature is going to take 50 weeks to build, but will only be used by 5% of our users. Most organizations that are driven by Gantt charts will not pay attention to some of those types of data and will continue to deliver that value, even though the actual cost to value ratio is down now by 99%. We've lost 99% of the expected value of that thing, and you're going to tell me you're going to still build it.
Yep.
That's why project plans, adherence to project plan can be a deadly metric to use. Do not use adherence to plan as a proxy, if you will. Man, I totally soapboxed that, got way ahead of myself, because we are going to talk about this when we talk about fast feedback and why feedback is so critical and how to get that feedback.
Right. I'm actually going to come in with an interesting example of the adherence to the project plan being what you're measuring. This actually comes directly from Don Reinertsen's book, so if you want to see it in more detail, go ahead and check it out. But it's the idea of missiles and firing a missile at a moving target versus firing a missile at a stationary target. Completely different targeting systems depending on what you're aimed at. And the modern services-oriented software delivery mode, our target is constantly moving. It's not a static target. We can't program in a solution and shoot it and you know, fire and forget, right? What we need to be making constant course corrections to point in the direction of our new target. So we know generally where the target is, we let it go, and then we measure very rapidly and constantly course correct to point at where the target is now. If you are adhering to a plan you wrote 6 months ago, it's shooting at a target that isn't where your actual target is anymore. And all of that is money lost.
And especially since your customers seem to be taking evasive maneuvers.
Right.
I mean, it really feels like that sometimes, right? That your customers, you think they're on this path, and then, wow, they read some article in Inc. magazine, and now, whoop, they're off in some other way. That is a great, great point. And a lot of those ideas, again, you've heard in Agile courses.
Right.
No different. That same idea of targeting is very, very important. That's a great example. So the bottom line, if we go back to the slides, we just say it succinctly, utilization is an extremely inaccurate proxy for value throughput. We did that on quite a few rants, but that's the way to put it in a very tight, tweetable format, if you would. Utilization is used by tools like Microsoft Project, using Gantt charts. Let's flip that. Let's think about things like value flow and measuring something like a feature. I mean, even just measuring how long did it take to get a feature through is far better than utilization. How hard did we work to get that feature out the door? All right. So now, again, another way to state this.
So this is my personal favorite one, which is high utilization combined with inherent variability and flow rates has a non-linear effect on throughput. Which is a mouthful, but when you break it down, you think about, we load a system to high levels of utilization, we shove as much stuff as we possibly can in there, and then we say, we're not exactly sure how long any of that is gonna live inside our system. Eventually, we have a non-linear impact on throughput. We have uncontrolled congestion. Flow just stops. And it kind of goes back to our first slide, which was, at some point, we have a highly utilized, incredibly efficient IT organization that just flat out doesn't ever deliver what the customer needs when the customer needs it.
And to graph that, I went back to our MM1 Infinity queue. This is a queue under high utilization, right. Just like you said. High utilization to this side and high variability.
Right.
If we have low variability, it looks like this. It's still going to get up to infinity, but it takes a lot longer to get there.
Yep.
And if we have a lot of variation, it's going to look something like this.
Yes.
Which is where you don't want to be. You want to be down here to a point, right? And this is where variation, let's draw another curve. What's the cost to eliminate variation?
Right.
Can I do one more U-shaped curve?
by all means.
We were wrapping
this up.
We love
U-shaped curves.
So this was our utilization, right? And given this, we're saying we need to drive down utilization. I won't draw it up
right here.
I'll leave that as an exercise to the viewer. But what you can do is then draw on this, what is the cost to reduce variability? And what you're going to find is that it can be very expensive to reduce variability.
Or impossible.
Or impossible. So if you're spending too much to reduce variability, you're not going to get the benefits of moving down to here that you think you would because it's so expensive. Again, it's a trade-off.
The typical ways we try to reduce variability in software development, big plans up front, you know, giant design phases where we've planned out all of the architecture and all of those sorts of things, which historically we all know and understand that those backfire quite rapidly. Mm-hmm.
Good. So there's a better way. And this better way feels an awful lot like Kanban. If you flip back to the slides, this is from Mary Popendick. And it's limit work to capacity. Basically what this means is if your people can do a set amount of work, don't provide more. Don't provide more than they can accomplish.
This one I like to call it this one because this isn't explicitly called out in Kanban. It's kind of implicit in the whole Kanban system, but it's not explicitly called out usually when people teach Kanban. And we find that it's a huge problem. If I go back to the examples where I said most people, when I ask how long would it take to work through your existing backlog, it's 7 years. That's because they're consistently putting more on the backlog than their teams could ever possibly get done. It's something I like to call kill the zombies, which is go through your backlogs on a regular basis and find the things which is going to be like 70% or 80% that you're never going to do. If it's been sitting in your backlog for 2 years, you're never going to do it. In fact, it probably doesn't even apply anymore. If you did it, it wouldn't add any value. So stop tracking and prioritizing against those things. Kill them. Get them off your backlogs. You've got to match your inflow to your outflow, at least in approximation. Otherwise, you will never shrink queues. They'll always grow. There's no other way around it.
And I've seen places that actually will go through and find bugs that are older than 3 months or 6 months and just delete the bugs. Just they're like, right. The bugs are gone.
It's a feature.
It's the meantime. Cheryl Hammond on our team, she says that's the meantime to feature. How long does it take a bug to turn into a feature of the application? But cutting those, I mean, frankly, if it's been 6 months, your underlying platforms even change, so it's not going to apply. Next one is even out that arrival of work. As you're balancing the flow, even out the arrival of the work so it's not coming in sporadically in giant plumps. Now, does this mean that sprint planning won't work, that you can't take a chunk and plan it for a sprint? No, that's an even cadence of work. You can take something, here's what we think we can do in a sprint, plop, and run it. That's a fairly even cadence. It's when we start going crazy and blowing it out of the cadences.
Well, one of the ways we see this is the budgeting for the entire year of software development all in one go, right? You've got your 1 week meeting where if you don't get your budget approved for your software project, you're not doing it for a year. That would be an uneven arrival of work. My teams are working in 2 week sprints. My budgetary approval process happens once a year.
That's an excellent one.
That's a giant batch to try to shove into your system.
It is. So now we'll come to number three, limit the number of items that are in process. She calls them things in process.
Right.
I love that. In Kanban, we'd call it a WIP limit, a work in process limit. Limit those and limit the size of those things too. This is just a brilliant way to lay it out. I love the way she's laid this out. Don't try to build big, giant things. Try to limit them to smaller things within reason.
Right.
We've talked about variability. You don't want to spend 3 months trying to make sure everything will fit into an exactly 12.5 developer day effort chunks. Right? You're going to have some variation in there. But try to bring it down to smaller sizes of things.
I bet we could find a U-shaped optimization in there somewhere.
Ooh, you know we could. And establish a regular cadence. This is a cadence for meetings, a cadence for delivery. Some people do Scrum, and in that case, you have built-in cadences for planning and releasing and demoing. Other people apply an artificial cadence on something that is a continuous delivery model. They might have a planning cadence for once a month, people get together and fund things. Once a week, people get together and celebrate what they've released. Once every 2 weeks, they do some backlog grooming and come up with better things. And the last thing is use pull scheduling. And pull really means that I don't get... I'm not working on things. There's not things on my plate until I'm able to pull them onto my plate and take them. In other words, Andrew's not going to just pile a bunch of stuff on my plate. I will pull it. I'll say, this is what I want next. And then I can, not necessarily right. what I want, but this is what I can take on and work. That's pull scheduling. By the way, there's a very strong correlation between pull scheduling and WIP limits. By opposing WIP limits, you are by definition creating a pull system. It's kind of an interesting thing.
Right.
All right.
So
go ahead.
Jump in for here just 1 second on this last slide is, it's important to note that these things scale to multiple levels of your organization, right? And that's why I actually like things in process better than work in process. Work in process is a very team level term. But things in process scales appropriately across your whole organization, right? If I'm the CIO of a multi-billion dollar organization, my things in process are quite large. But I want to limit the number of them that I have in process. And that scales up and down the ladder of the organization quite well. So scoping your viewpoint throughout the levels of your organization is quite important.
That was a great lead-in and plug for next week as well.
When we talk about Enterprise Agile, and we'll talk about how you can use Kanban and some tools from the Agile movement to make that work across your organization.
Awesome. Cultural flag. Typing speed does not determine developer productivity, right? Punishing individuals who appear not to be busy enough will often work against the delivery of value. I threw in there, but not always, because clearly if someone's never working on things,
right.
they're not delivering value either. So 0% utilization's bad, 100% utilization's bad, but from a cultural perspective, if you walk by a developer's office, and the developer is leaning back in their chair, staring at the ceiling, chances are they're coding. chances are they're coding, right? It's not an unutilization thing. I get to manage a company. I get to lead a company. And I'm going to try to bring in some of what I try to do here as a lesson learned as well. Frankly, if people feel as a culture that you're letting them possibly look at the ceiling and not code while they're looking at the ceiling, but just taking a break, they're often more inclined to, when they're taking a shower or falling asleep, be coding,
right?
They're thinking about things throughout the day. If you've tightly constrain them and says, no, I'm paying you to be here from 8 to 5 and you will think during this time. And what happens is...
501, I am not thinking.
501, the brain shuts off,
yep.
right? And what you want, that's not happy for the people there either. For your developers, it's a very creative act. And what you want is a culture that embraces the fact that sometimes their utilization will be lower than other times, even while they're at work. Because work doesn't just happen at work. It's going to happen all over the place.
Right.
And developers will feel better about their life if they can think of, you know, their brains can be running at other parts of the day.
Right.
All right. We will be taking a meal break for about an hour. We'll return at the, I believe, top of the hour. Barry, where are we returning?
It's 40 after right now. So
40 after?
It's not exactly.
It'll be about an hour, probably coming back in at about 15 minutes till. There's going to be a timer that you'll be able to see. So welcome to the meal break for those of you approximating our time zone. And for those of you who aren't, welcome to your nap break. All right. Thank you very much. We're going to be coming back and actually showing some games that you can play with your managers to help them understand this concept of flow.
And we'll also be answering a lot of the questions that we haven't gotten to during lunch and coming up next. So if your question hasn't been answered, don't fret too much yet. We will be getting to as many of those as we can in the next little while.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll see you in about an hour.